Okay, we'll call the meeting to order. We have the Secretary of State, the Treasurer, and the Attorney General on the line, and we also have Executive Secretary Barry, and I know I heard the Deputy Executive Secretary talking there, and Vicky's here. Who else is present from BCPL?
Oh, you got Rich Snyder and Vicky and Mike.
All right. Hello, everyone. Then we've got the minutes from the January 5th meeting in as one of our attachments.
I'll move we approve those minutes. I remember them.
I will second that. Any discussion on them? All in favor, say aye.
Matt, aye. I'll say aye.
And aye, Brad. So I heard both of you come in there, so we are unanimous on the minutes. And then we can get on to the loans, also an attachment for this month. This meeting. We have five loans for almost $2.5 million. First off, can we get a motion
We approve the five loans. This is Doug.
Okay, I'll second that. Is there any discussion regarding them?
Your public purpose question has been asked.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right, I missed it. Have these been approved for proper public purpose?
Yes, they have.
Okay, thank you. And then we can continue on. Any discussion? All right, then we'll go ahead and take a vote. All in favor, say aye. Aye, Brad.
Aye, Doug.
I was mad. I'll vote no.
Okay. Then we will move those loans forward.
I just have one question.
Oh, go ahead.
It says the third loan is for 14 years. That's an odd number instead of 10 or 20. And number five is for 4 years. Do we do those kind? I guess we do.
Yes, we do. We let the borrower determine the term of the loan.
Okay.
And in those cases, they chose to have them be 4 years and 14 years.
And we just tie the interest rate to the closest one to ours.
Right. Our interest rates are for ranges, and if that term is within that range, then that's the interest rate they will receive on the loan.
Oh, funny. I never noticed that before. Thank you.
You bet.
Basically, Doug, 5 years and under is 3%, and above is 3.5%, and higher than that, 3.75%. But there's one proviso, and you want to talk about Algoma?
Yeah, there is one loan in there that's a revenue loan, and so it is the rate on that loan has been determined through an analysis of the revenue stream for that loan, and so rather than be within the general obligation loan rates, there's a higher rate on that loan because it is not a general obligation, it's a revenue loan. And so that rate is 3.75% for a five-year term, where a normal rate for a five-year loan would be 3.25%.
Okay.
Brad, this is Jonathan. That Algoma loan at 3.75% is just as secure because we have access to the state aids, but it's a reflection of market that they might have difficulty getting a rate any better because of it's attached to revenue, not their general obligation. For us, we've got access, we've got all the security we need, but we can charge a little more, so we are.
That's right.
Okay. And we have no old business. On to new business, we have number four, discussion and vote on staff attending the Fixed Income Conference in Chicago. And there is an attachment setting forth the estimated costs for that. I've had some discussion already with this on this with Tom and Jonathan. I'll move to approve that, and if we can get a second, then we can have the discussion.
I'll second it. I don't know much about it, but I presume we'll get a good report when they get back about the walks on the waterfront and Chicago winds and things.
This is Jonathan, Doug. I wish I could say that was the case. That damn conference starts at 7:30 in the morning and goes till 3:30 in the afternoon, and I'm going to have a hard time keeping my eyes open.
Uh-huh.
But I determined that it would be useful to learn the taxonomy of fixed income investment. The conference itself is free, run by a publication, Pension and Investment magazine in Chicago, and the speakers are pretty high quality, so it's just seemed a reasonably cost-effective way of continuing our education.
Okay, just don't get in any poker games at night.
Yes, sir.
This is Matt. I'll just speak very briefly. I guess I appreciate with Jonathan over there, this is the first time I've ever seen one of these added to our agenda where at least there's detail what the expenses were going to be, you know, so I appreciate that. Like I've always said, I generally don't support conference travel, so, but I won't make a big deal of it.
Okay. My understanding, Matt, is that the previous board meeting indicated that the board would like to see approval of any out-of-state travel, and even though this is just barely out-of-state, it's still out-of-state.
So I appreciate that, Donna, and I think we should at least see it, because typically in the past we never saw it. And even when they did go, it was never a breakdown. It just said, can so-and-so go? It never actually broke it down. So,
well, I will confess that I like to put the breakdown in here because it's so cheap.
All righty.
Okay. Any further discussion on this? Then I will call for the vote. All in favor, say aye. Aye, Brad.
Aye, Doug.
This is Matt. I'll say no.
Okay. Then on to item number 5, we have a discussion of the quarterly investment report, and I'm going to turn this over. Is it, you guys going to have Rich do this?
Yeah, I'll just kick it off, and Rich is here to address any questions and to expand on it. But this is, a standard report. But the news is actually pretty good. I mean, when we have a fourth quarter interest earnings exceeding the benchmark by $2.16 million and a capital gains realization of $1.2 million, that seemed to me to be worth highlighting, and asked Rich to kind of get into the detail of that.
I can do that. Thanks, Jonathan. You know, there have been some questions raised by the state treasurer in prior board meetings about the trust fund loan program and whether or not loans were a good investment for the trust funds, and so I provided an analysis within this report. On page 2, the chart of the report compares the average interest rate of loans within the BCPL portfolio first to treasuries of a similar maturity to establish our spread. Now, the BCPL spread is the difference between the average loan yield and the risk-free treasury yield. And the spread is a commonly used tool within the industry to compare the relative value of fixed income investments to each other, excuse me. As a general rule, investments with a similar risk should have a similar spread, and as the spread increases, the spread will increase as the risk increases. And then after the BCPL spread is calculated, we compare it to the spreads available on corporate bonds of various credit qualities, and this data is available from the Federal Reserve System. And as you can see, the calculation on January 12th showed that the BCPL loan portfolio had a spread of 2.25%. Now, after informal discussions with various bankers and institutional investors and other market participants, including representatives from Moody's, we believe that the appropriate credit rating for the trust fund loan program is AA1, which is one notch below a AAA rating. And there are really two reasons for this high credit rating for the loan portfolio. One, there's never been a default in the program since it was established in 1871. And perhaps more importantly to the credit rating agencies, BCPL has the right and the responsibility to intercept state aid due to borrowers should there ever be a default. Now, if we go back to the chart, you can see that a corporate bond with an AA1 rating has a current spread of approximately 0.85%. And when you compare this to the BCPL spread of 2.25%, you'll see a difference of 1.4%. Now, what this shows is that BCPL is able to generate about 2.5 times the spread available on corporate bonds of a similar risk profile. This is a really highly unusual situation in the efficient capital markets of today and is a great advantage to BCPL and the trust fund beneficiaries. Now, the basis of this advantage stems from our ability to originate market interest rate loans to lower-rated and non-rated communities and convert these loans to a much higher credit rating because of our ability to intercept state aid. This is a very powerful tool that generates a lot of value. And so I believe that this analysis shows that there is really no question that the loan program is able to generate excess returns for the amount of risk assumed. Now, in dates prior, BCPL has decided to keep these loans in-house and distribute these excess returns to the beneficiaries. But in the future, as we move forward in diversifying our portfolio, it may make sense to sell packages of these loans to capture the excess returns as capital gains and to reinvest those funds in additional loans or other assets. But that's a bridge we can cross at a later date. I hope this analysis answers some of the questions that have been raised in regards to the loan program. Does anybody have any questions?
I've got one, just a comment. This is Jonathan. I asked Rich to elaborate on this, board members, because we're on the threshold now of developing a investment policy guidelines to submit to the board to have a discussion on how and when we may utilize this prudent person investing policy or rule now. And so it's looked to me to be good to just have a base of understanding of what we're actually doing today.
Yeah, this is Matt. I appreciate the work put in by Rich and Jonathan on this. I think it's important to look at this type of stuff. And obviously, I recognize that these trust fund loans, obviously, they're, as you said, we've never had a failure. We've never that's defaulted, so that's good. My only concern is historically looking at it, and Jonathan there has been kind enough to tell me that he's going to provide by the end of the week or next week kind of our long-term, how, over the last 10, 15, 20 years, what kind of performance the trust fund loan had. It's my fear that before, maybe 10 years ago or so, maybe 10 to 20 years ago, that they were giving away these loans kind of at a really good rate and we weren't making very much.
Well, Matt, I think we'll have that by the beginning of next week, I'm told by Rich.
I appreciate that.
I think I'll concur with your assessment. It will probably show that about 11 or 12 years ago, our rates of return weren't very good. But in the last 10, 11 years, they have been quite good in comparison to the benchmarks.
Yep, and I think this will be good as a talking point. And Rich mentioned to me when we met in my office, and I really like the idea of possibly trying to, if it's doable and we could make money, as Rich said, where we could package some of these and, you know, use our originator to our advantage. That's definitely interesting to me.
Okay. That's all I have on that. Any questions for Rich?
No, not a question from me, but it's great work, Rich, and all that you know, your team has done to be so successful with this, and thanks for putting together for us in such an organized way.
Thank you.
All right. Then on to other agenda items anyone wants to discuss today. Okay. And then we have Executive Secretary's report. And Jonathan, are you going to...
It's very brief, Brad. I added an attachment here of a balance sheet for the last 5 years, and the motivation on that was that I've been going around, hopefully increasingly, meeting with key legislators, and most recently met with Representative Mark Lyne, Senator Mark Lyne.
Yep.
And he asked for the balance sheet, and we produced it the very next day for him. And this balance sheet, it's worth noting, first of all, we've grown the fund, not me. I haven't been here long enough to claim any credit for any of this. But we've grown the fund by 18.2% since 2011, from $835 million to $987 million. And within these figures, it's worth noting the change and a shift. Our loans to local governments in FY2011 were around $407 million, and today they're $269. Similarly, the bond investments in 11 were $126,708, and today they're $496,411. And I guess I think this tells a fairly good story in the sense that somebody here was on the ball and recognized that we would have refinancing and that would accelerate from the loans to local governments, and took advantage of that opportunity to move more into bond investments, capturing perhaps not as much interest, but also then capturing some capital gains, which, as we realize it, is added to our earnings. And as an example in this report that Rich just gave us, I believe we have $1.2 million in realized capital gains. This is, I think, again, something useful to note as we contemplate moving into a prudent investment strategy, because we may be able to, we should be able to capture more realized capital gains and, in fact, estimate our performance based on mark-to-market determination, which these figures show. So the actual fund balance is reflective of, I think, almost $15 million. Am I correct, Rich?
That's right.
Unrealized capital gains right now.
As of today, you know, as of the end of the year, I believe that the value of the bond was about $15 million more than the cost. That's right.
So that was an intelligent decision that the previous board made and staff before my time undertook to implement, and it tells a good story. I can say that Senator Markline was favorably disposed with that.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you, Doug. I guess you're the only one around here who can claim credit for it. If there are any no questions on that, the only other thing I wanted to just relate Tom's and my visit to Mud Lake and Tree Haven. It was a pretty good meeting. It was part of my continuing education, I'd say. But we had about 15, we did have 15 attendees at Tree Haven, four of which were BCPL staff. So we had 11 real people. Of that, about three that were part of the timber industry, which I found a little disappointing. Henry Scheinemann was the best one to talk to. Scheinebeck was the best one for me to talk to. I've since been in communication with he and some of the others, as Tom and I intend to go back up there on the 28th and the 29th. Because we were unable, because of weather, to get to the actual Mud Lake site. It was freezing rain, and it was an hour and a quarter further drive on ice-covered roads. So we all elected to just not do the site visit. Instead, ended our visit at the at Tree Haven, where UW Stevens Point and John Schwartzman gave a presentation on our approach to harvesting Mud Lake. And you probably have seen the report, and if anybody wants the PowerPoint, I can certainly get it to you. But the recommendation is to go to a single tree selection harvest as opposed to a group selection or a diameter limit cut. A diameter limit cut basically means you cut every tree in the woods that's above a certain diameter. And not surprisingly, when you do that, you get more board feet today. But not surprisingly, again, you get a heck of a lot less in the future. The single tree selection is what is being recommended, but first this group selection is basically harvesting with an eye towards opening up the crown, get more area that would presumably show greater regeneration, except that the analysis shows that when we have a larger area, both in our woods and the adjacent woods, open to the sunlight, the regeneration is more in the order of berry bushes, blackberry, elderberry, and ironwood, and almost no actual forestry regeneration. So the recommendation is for a single tree selection, and the woods have been marked to that end, and we're getting comment now from the timber industry people. It will generate this year, actually in 16, a harvest of about $100,000 plus or minus a little bit in gross timber sales to BCPL. What's more interesting, and in 15 years, we can expect another harvest of equal or greater size, whereas if we went to the diameter limit cut, we would get about 50% more now, but much less later. So on the theory that we want to make money now and in the future and manage this woods to the best practical end, it's recommended we go with a single site, single tree selection. I think, much as I know about it, it made a lot of sense to me, but what was more important to me is the industry professionals that are up there on looking at all of this information. And I would say in general all agree, but there's some more comments yet to be had. So where you can, if you add this to 2015, where we're averaging about $600,000 in gross timber sales, we expect 2016 to be somewhat greater, because as you know, when we let a bid, they've got 3 years to make the harvest, but we don't realize the income until the harvest is made and we receive the revenue. It looks like 16 will be substantially greater year than 15 was, and 15 was about average. That's all I wanted to report on that. I'll be glad to attempt to answer any questions with my newfound knowledge.
Sounds good to me. Thank you.
There have, along the way here, there have been a number of concerns raised by some Northwoods legislators, and they identified that particular property. Were they involved in the trip out to the woods at all?
The legislators were not, but I intend to follow up in visiting with them, and I'm scheduling, seeing how Tom and I are going up again on the 28th and 29th, I'm scheduling some visits with people like Krause and others, Bobby Connors, and again, Henry, and I want to get their input because they may not be willing to write written comments, but I'm hopeful that they'll be willing to relate exactly how they view this in person.
There's one question about the process when you're doing the single tree harvesting, which makes sense. I listened to you carefully. Then we replant, or do we not replant unless we're doing clear cuts? Because if we're trying to generate hardwood, it might be desirable to plant some trees in those areas, but I'm not sure. Maybe John would have to answer that.
But I'm informed, and John informed me, I asked that question too, is that we're having a dickens of a time getting any planting regeneration because of the deer depredation. We have, however, in this woods a substantial number of thrifty hardwood maple trees coming up in the 8, 9, 10, 12-inch diameter that will be, you know, will no longer be suppressed by the single tree selection, so we can expect greater growth. I should say that we're not just cutting trees there that are of a diameter and up. We're also cutting trees that look to be at the peak of their value, and that includes some veneer wood that is smaller diameter that we expect, based on this UW-Stevens Point study, not to substantially increase in value in between now and 15 years from now. So we're making a little broader selection, and the timber industry professionals concurred with that, which I found to be helpful, you know, or gratifying, I guess.
Here, this is Doug again. This is kind of going off on a tangent, but maybe something to talk to John up there about. We've faced this deer issue now for as long as I can remember. And it's very, very bad for hemlocks, of course, and for the maples, and for the swamp birches, etc. Would it make any sense to pick an area and put up a fence, maybe fence off, I'm thinking an eighth of an acre or whatever makes sense, and in that place plant a number of maples, hemlocks, etc.?
I don't know the answer to that, Doug, other than it's a matter of cost, I'm sure. We're getting good regeneration of the maples, and they do really well until they get above the snow line, and then the deer come and nip them off.
I understand.
And, you know, I don't know what the answer to this is. My woodlot and my farm, I've planted over 20,000 trees since I've been on the farm. It went great about 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. Now I can't get a tree to grow on a bet because the deer turn them all into bushes. I think it's a DNR management issue that's at stake here, too.
Right, I understand. And certainly, if it's one or two trees in your yard, you can put a fence around them. I just wondered if anyone's ever thought about putting up a fairly serious fence around a fairly big area, maybe one square block or something, and trying and putting, you know, several dozen trees in that area.
I just don't think it would be cost-effective, Doug, but I will bring that question to John Schwartzman.
It wouldn't cost that much to put up a fence like that, I don't think. Anyway, maybe a few hundred dollars. Okay, thank you.
All right. They make scarecrows for cornfields. Can we put some scarecrows that look like wolves up there?
No. We are getting regeneration in this woodlot that is pretty impressive from what I've. But again, I haven't been on site. It's just been described to me. I'll let you know better after I get up there and actually trot around in it and somebody points it out to me.
Okay.
I guess the main thing is we can book pretty substantially a $100,000 timber harvest from this one site in this year, in 16, and all the data shows that we can expect an equal or greater harvest in 15 years. And then another one after that in another 15 years. So it appears to be a sustainable strategy.
Okay. Anything else on the executive secretary report?
Nope, that's it. It's part of my learning curve here, but Matt and I are going to meet with Mike Williamson and his staff at SWIB on February 3rd, I believe. I've had one meeting with SWIB, and I can tell you that they're very eager to assist us in developing our investment policies and perhaps even collaborating and piggybacking on some of their investments. And we do have an issue, Matt, Brad, because we have, if you notice in this investment report that Rich just gave you, we're projecting by March to have as much as $175 million in dead cash. It behooves us to find a good place to put that money to work. By no means will all of that or any of it necessarily be wanted by the Bucks Arena. So we're really looking at a need to step up our game. Now, that could change if local government loan demand increases, but we don't sense that it's going to dramatically in the next quarter.
All right. Well, there are worse problems to have.
Yeah, that's true.
I'll move we adjourn.
I'll second that.
Thank you. Take care, everyone.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.